Good morning and welcome to Up to Date. I am Elizabeth Alex, in for Steve Kraske today, and I'm delighted to be here. The economic policies of the United States have been the topic of heated debate, dividing political parties, scholars, even members of families who are passionate about the direction they believe the country should be going or should not be going. Both the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street movements claim they have the true values of what the founding of our finances was meant to be. But what's the real story? Here to put some perspective on that, William Hoagland, author of Founding Finance, How Debt, Speculation, Foreclosures, Protests, and Crackdowns Made Us a Nation. He'll also be talking about his book this evening at the Kansas City Public Library Central Branch. Bill Hoagland, welcome to Up to Date.
Thanks a lot. Glad to be here.
Well, first describe for us what you mean, in a nutshell, by America's perpetual historical denial of America's all-important economic funding clashes.
Yeah, well, the early days of America are often, I mean, we talk about conflict in that era, of course, conflict between Americans and the British. And
that's even, what we think of it was, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And some conflicts among Americans, but we rarely look at those issues in terms of money and economics. And I think we were fighting at that time about some of the very same issues we're fighting about today.
And how does that, in your opinion, what does that mean for us today? What can we learn from that today?
Well, that's a good question. And I think that's the, you know, that's what we need to sort of dig into a little more. And that's what some of what I'll be talking about tonight at the library is. The lessons are maybe a little more complicated than we've been comfortable considering. And so what I'm trying to do is kind of clear some ground and crack into some of these things. And I both sort of I'm grateful to the Tea Party movement and to the Occupy movement for raising these issues. And I've been critical of both of those groups and of liberals and conservatives in how they all deal with how we all deal with these issues now.
Yeah, I think from reading your book, you're pretty balanced on that. You kind of take both of them to task in some ways or point out where maybe they maybe have kind of a foggy memory.
Yeah, I think when you lean on the founders for the founding and essential values of the country to try to win your arguments, you just often find yourself in a back and forth. I think we've been in this, not just the Tea Party and Occupy, but all of us have been in this for a long time, where we're using the Constitution and we're using the founders' values to kind of, or how we perceive them, to bop each other over the heads and just try to end the argument. And I just think there's other ways we could be using that material.
Yeah, bopping each other over the head is kind of putting it politely, really.
Yeah, I guess it is.
In your chapter, Riot, Regulate, Occupy, you describe kind of a rich history of rising up against economic oppression, of corruption, sometimes at the hands of the rich, trade wars that maybe didn't really help the common man. And you say historians have long argued over which came first, American love of smuggling or American love of liberty. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, well, the British had a point of view, which, of course, it's worth considering. It doesn't mean we need to adopt it, that much of the American discussion of liberty was a feature of self-interest on the part of the merchant class that didn't really like paying the taxes or having any regulation, really, of some of their activities. And famous founders like John Hancock, for one, were considered by many to be smugglers first and libertarians second. That's a partial view and an interested view held by Tories and the British and many members of the British government. But it's worth considering some of the economic contexts in which some of our basic founding ideas arose.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Alexander Hamilton. Maybe the last chapter even of your book. It's kind of like, this is Hamilton's world. We're all just living in it. As a Treasury Secretary, he consolidated the war debt of all the states. Some people weren't really happy about that. He centralized the government, supported taxing powers, allowed speculators to buy bonds from Revolutionary soldiers who were great patriots, and then for pennies on the dollar, then they sold them at great property. These speculators did. Is that what you would call the seeds of our current system today?
Well, it's one of the C's. The Hamiltonians today definitely point to Hamilton as the person who really foresaw modern industrial America and the fluid capital markets of today and so forth. It's a possibly painful but nonetheless realistic view to take of Hamilton, to see him as someone who really wanted to concentrate American wealth in a few hands, the rationale being that really you wanted a government-connected class of very highly capable financiers and industrialists to really build the nation. He wanted to stop dissipating wealth around family farms and across small artisan shops and really gather it up into a powerful national force. And that really drove a lot of his finance philosophy.
But that kind of goes against the idea of a decentralized government, or that the states should really be controlling their own finances.
Yeah, it goes very much against that, actually. And it goes against certain ideas about equality and democracy that Hamilton had very little patience for and didn't make too many bones about that either.
Well, he was quite a character, too, just in general.
He was a brilliant and intense personality. And I think without him, it would have been, it's hard for me anyway, to imagine how the nation would have become the kind of national, the kind of force that it became.
Well, he did do some things that were considered to have hurt people. Some people suffer as a result of some of his policies, but it was generally considered overall for the greater good of the country that might not have survived economically had he not done some of these things.
Yeah, that's right. And I think I like to sort of pause there a little bit, you know, hit the pause button and just look for a second at the conflict that you just alluded to. I think we're kind of quick to say, well, it was a set of problems that affected and hurt a lot of people. But on the other hand, without it, we wouldn't have become a nation. I think those are both true. I just think we're a little bit prone to run past that issue and not look at that, for example, as one of the founding dissonances in our coming into being as a people. And I think we still struggle with that today.
Well, also Hamilton, he didn't believe in a total balanced budget. He believed in some debt.
He very much believed in a public debt as a positive good for building a nation. It was sort of through the debt, the national debt, not by paying it off, but by funding it via taxation and other measures. He believed that was exactly how you created a kind of a high finance class, an investment class, a speculating class that had close ties to government.
And does the Tea Party kind of misremember a little bit of that, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think the Tea Party and the sort of the larger group that might just refer to itself now as constitutional conservatives, I think they tend to misremember some of those things. I think when they talk about the founders, they're talking in very broad terms about a kind of liberty-oriented founding. And many members of the Tea Party that I've spoken to, actually, and discussed and debated with are very down on Hamilton. They don't hold back, really, from criticizing Hamilton. But then again, the question would arise, as I think it arose at the time, regarding how would we then have become a consolidated nation if indeed we hadn't founded that nation partly on a large public debt supported by taxes.
Now, James Madison opposed Hamilton's idea about the national debt. Who do you think its ideas won? Was it Hamilton's? And was that a good thing, or should it have been more of a combination?
Well, I think to a great extent, Hamilton's ideas won. So I would agree probably with the Hamiltonians of today who really admire that. And again, I sort of hit a little rewind and then hit pause and kind of look at, you know, what was going on. I remain kind of focused on and even obsessed with possibly the idea that we could look closely at, just look at that conflict a little longer instead of resolving it. Because I discuss in the book, and I'll get into a little more of this tonight at the Central Library, the conflict between Hamilton and Madison is a very fraught one, actually. They started out as partners and friends, mm-hmm. and colleagues, and then they had this kind of classic giant breakup over this idea of funding the debt. And I like to hover over that a little bit and sort of unpack it.
Good. Well, we'll be anxious to hear how that goes. How do all these ideas, in your opinion, I'm going to ask this probably several times through our conversation, how do they resonate in today's political arena outside of bopping each other over the head with it? We're talking about the mounting, you know, the national debt that everyone is worried about, and the ever looming government sequester cuts.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, the way I look at how we can use history, our history, our founding history, to consider how to think about those things, it really doesn't involve coming up with a solution based on founding principles. I think what I'm pushing back against is the idea that we can look to the founders for our solutions. I look to the founders. I write about founding history, and I dig into it pretty hard. Mm-hmm. But what I keep coming up with is these kinds of fairly stark and dire conflicts among them and among the famous founders and ordinary people of the period over these very issues. So the takeaway for me isn't really to say, well, Occupy is right and the Tea Party is wrong, or the liberals are right and the conservatives are wrong, or vice versa. I don't think you have to draw a particular policy conclusion from any of the things I talk about. But I do think we could learn by looking at those conflicts to get over using the founders as weapons to attack one another with.
Well, how do you believe the Occupy Wall Street movement ties itself to the founding of our country to prove their point?
In a much less blatant way than the Tea Party movement, for example, does, since the Occupy people do not wear the three-corner hats and dress up as George Washington and sort of do the reenactment piece
of that.
Well,
they do have the tents.
Yeah, that's true. Yes. But they do refer very specifically to, I mean, very constantly to we the people, the first three words of the Constitution, as to invoke the idea that the founding was about the people, about the 99%. And they also there's a really interesting article in the Occupy Wall Street Journal that was out during the occupation in Zuccotti Park, in which they associated their movement there in the park with the Liberty Tree in Boston. Interesting association, because there was a lot of populism and egalitarianism in Boston around the Liberty Tree. But they also are kind of roping in some of the more famous Boston founders who really in some ways were at odds with ordinary people at the time.
Yeah. Well, the founding fathers, of course, said nothing about Medicare, Medicaid, welfare, Social Security, federal government financing student loans. Would the founding fathers be on the side of Occupy movement?
Well, I think
in any of these areas?
I think in many ways we'd have to look at, say, a George Washington, and I discuss this in the book in some detail, as being so authoritarian in his behavior as president that indeed he would have done much to crack down on the Occupy movement. And I think he also would have done much to crack down on the Tea Party movement. Washington was not someone who brooked much criticism, and he acted with great aggression against the people known as the Whiskey Rebels in western Pennsylvania in the 1790s, just for example.
You wrote a whole book about this Whiskey Rebellion, correct?
I did, yeah, with my first book.
Well, I want to give people the chance to call in and ask you questions if they want to. If you have a question or comment for Bill Hoagland, we'd like to hear it. You can call us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also email us. Our address is updatedate@kcur.org. If you're a Tea Partier or a Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street person, we'd like to hear from you if you've got a question. Let's talk a little bit. One thing I like about your book is it's really not just a bunch of numbers. You're telling stories. You're telling each character kind of develop the character. I'd like to hear more about Herman Husband. Tell us about him and how he plays into this, because that's not a name that, you know, every school kid's learning in the fifth grade.
It's not. It's not a name that every school kid's learning, and it's not a name that, you know, many people very well up on American history American founding history have good reason to not ever have heard that name, actually. I've done my best to push back against that and try to change it. I would love it if Herman Husband were a household name, but I don't know if he ever will be. He was, to me, one of the most fascinating members of the founding generation. He was a true egalitarian radical. And people often say it's anachronistic to look at that period and imagine very communitarian, even socialistic thinking that sort of prefigures at least the New Deal and the Great Society. But Herman Husband was not alone, but he was one of the most articulate of the people of that era who were that radically egalitarian and believed that government really should be actively supporting the interests of ordinary people and actively restraining the power of wealth.
And sometimes religion entered into how they viewed economic policies. Did other cultures or race ever enter into those?
Well, the way religion entered in is again, one of the most interesting things to me in terms of how we think about these matters today, because Herman Husband was one of many populist egalitarians who was also a fervent evangelical Christian. Frequently today, we think of the evangelical impulse as connecting with the right wing and with conservatism. But in those days, there was a very strong radical populist strain in evangelicalism. And that's something that I think has not been brought out very much. And Husband is one of those people, but there were others as well. In terms of other cultures and so forth, you know, the fact is these stories that I tell devolve very much on stories of white men. And it's something we really need to keep in mind, especially when we're talking about equal rights and egalitarianism, that even the people I'm talking about who were radical populists tended to be talking about equal rights for free white men over 21. And they were rarely proponents of women's rights, although Thomas Paine is an exception. And Herman Husband, when it came to women's rights, was very much an exception, too.
I want to once again remind our listeners, if you have a question or comment for our guest, we'd like to hear it. I'll read it very slowly. You can call us at 816-235-2888. Apparently, I was reading it too fast before. That's 816-235-2888. You can also email us. Our address is uptodate@kcur.org. And you can also send us something on our Facebook page, or you can tweet us. We're at KCUR UpToDate. So let's talk a little bit more about some of the things in the colonial era. You get into the age of railroads, the Industrial Revolution, the large-scale commercial production. You know, how did financial policies really start to shift in the 19th century to, like, accommodate this big business boom?
Yeah, well, the book kind of stops. I look ahead a little bit at the end of the book to sort of think about how these conflicts played out after the founding period, because one of the things I've come away with from my work on this is that the founders did not actually establish some of the things that we like to think of them as having established. For example, greater democracy, at least for, as I just said, you know, free white men of a certain age. So you have to kind of look ahead at the end of the book to see, well, things obviously changed. How did they change? And one of the things I'm looking at is the degree to which the values of both sides of this equation, the kind of Thomas Paine radical side and maybe the Alexander Hamilton industrial side, kind of got changed in the 19th century in ways that, you know, we take to sort of be part of our founding ethos, but actually represented change at the time.
Let's talk a little bit about the banks and what kind of role banks have played through our finances, through history. And, you know, has there always been this, or have there been periods of time when there has been anger about big banks and the too big to fail type banks and the banks ruling the world that there has been in the last 5 years or so?
This was a major feature of the kind of conflict among ordinary people and the high finance class at the very birth of the country, and I think it played very strongly into how we became a people. In Pennsylvania, there was a radical constitution that came about in 1776 that gave voting power to free white men, even if they had no property, and even if they had, and they could even run for office or hold office if they had no property. And they started passing laws. They got a very radical and very egalitarian assembly in Pennsylvania in 1776, and they started passing laws restraining, taking away really a charter for a central bank. And this was a huge crisis in Pennsylvania and really in the country because the Congress depended on that bank too.
So that's really not all that unusual then to hear about these bank issues.
No, I mean, it was kind of unusual. It was new at the time in some ways for the people involved. They were fighting over what were to them kind of newer issues. But no, this struggle among ordinary people and against the sense that banking can sometimes serve the interests of the rich at the expense of the poor, that sense was very much alive and well in the 1770s and 80s.
Okay. Well, we have a caller, James from Raytown, and he wants to talk about Washington and whiskey rebellions. Yes or no, Steve? He's nodding. Yes. Go ahead. James, you're on the air.
Hello there. Yes, I just had a question as it applies to finances or what Washington's problem was with the whiskey rebellion.
Well, Washington's problem with the Whiskey Rebellion was that the people we call the Whiskey Rebels were actually in a state of secession from the United States. They had gone that far. So one of the odd things about the Whiskey Rebellion is that it really wasn't a rebellion solely over whiskey. Alexander Hamilton is the first person to call it that, I think in some ways to kind of try to diminish its importance. But actually they were dead set against what they saw as regressive finance policies of the first Congress and the Washington administration. They attacked federal officials. They burned down the home of the federal tax collector in Western Pennsylvania. All of Western Pennsylvania was in rebellion, at least that's how the federal government looked at it, against federal policy. So Washington himself led troops, the president of the United States commanding troops in the field for, if not the only time, at least one of the very few times, against American citizens in western Pennsylvania. And they suppressed the entire area, including parts of western Virginia and western Maryland.
And was this part of this whiskey rebellion? Was Pennsylvania one of the states that had a whole lot of debt from the original Revolutionary War, and that was part of their problem?
Well, all the states had debt from the Revolutionary War, and what Hamilton was doing was kind of consolidating that all into one single centralized federal debt. And in doing that, he wanted to create a creditor class connected to the government, and he wanted to finance that debt, fund that debt, not pay it off, as so many people say, but fund it via a tax, specifically a tax on whiskey, which had many regressive features that he did not reveal to the Congress when he presented it, but that the people who had hit the hardest were keenly aware of and rebelled against, not because, as Hamilton suggested, they just liked to drink whiskey, but because they objected to his entire finance program.
Yeah, I can understand that. If you're just tuning in, we are listening to and visiting with William Hoagland. He's the author of Founding Finance, How Debt, Speculation, Foreclosures, Protests, and Crackdowns Made Us a Nation. And if you have a question for him, you can call us at 816-235-2888, 816-235-2888. Let's talk a little bit about after the United States became independent. How did those founding documents, like the Bill of Rights or the Constitution, really affect some of the structures of our finances or our banking system?
Well, there are aspects of the Constitution that people don't talk about that much today because they seem kind of maybe boring and dry compared to the things we talk about, the creation of the bicameral legislature and the executive and so forth and so on, the Supreme Court, and then the First Amendment and all that stuff we get kind of excited about. There are other elements in the Constitution that were very germane to this conflict I'm talking about, in which the states were prohibited, for example, from printing their own money, which seems like an obvious thing to do if you're going to have a nation. But actually, yeah, there had been a history of the states printing paper money partly to give debt relief to creditors. So things like that were prohibited by elements of the Constitution that seem kind of dry and formal, but actually at the time were very, very hot button items.
Can you compare what our founding finances were like to maybe a little bit of what Europe is going through right now?
Well, it's been during the Greek debt crisis, I was thinking about this, and it's always a little tricky to try to draw direct lines between things going on now and things going on in the 18th century because everything was so much different. But this issue about bondholders and their investments in bonds and how that affects economies and how that affects ordinary people, what degree of speculation a nation or a culture can tolerate and how bubbles build up. You know, you can look at it in Europe or you could look at it actually in the United States as well. I mean, the degree to which mad speculation took place in the United States in bonds and in land and so forth. And, you know, I don't know how exactly to tie that to the specifics of European debt, but I will note that our highest financiers, some of the great minds of finance of the 18th century American founding period, ended up in debtor's prison because of their inability to stop speculating during a huge bubble.
Well, and that's kind of seems to be part of the American tradition in some ways, that people they get very wealthy, then they way overspend, and then they crash, doesn't it?
It does seem that way, that, you know, you could see this speculation on the part of Robert Morris, our first central banker, and of his friends, and James Wilson, who was a brilliant Supreme Court justice and one of the framers of the Constitution. I mean, their personal inability to stop speculating and to keep the bubble going by their own kind of mad investing is a cautionary tale. And it does seem to have, you know, maybe there's an imprinting factor there in which, you know, we've inherited some of that
from
them.
So can we learn something from that?
That would be great. You know, I'd love to think that we could learn something from that. One of the things I think we could consider coming out of that is you know, Robert Morris and James Wilson, these finance brains of the period, and these legal brains of the period. Wilson was a great legal brain. These were the finance gurus of the period. It's not that they weren't; they were, and yet it's amazing to see that they had this addiction to speculation. So, you know, for individuals, I mean, everybody knows they shouldn't be overspending, but it's easy to say. It's hard to believe when actually the great finance leaders of your time are engaged in just such behavior.
Well, do you think, financial pressures, going back a little bit, some financial pressures from the British before the Revolutionary War, like the Stamp Act, do those still affect the relationship between like debtors and creditors in American society at that time and here?
Definitely, at the time, the British involvement was very important to, you know, the British intense involvement in American culture before the Revolution was very important to creating some of the financial pressures I'm talking about. It's interesting now, though, that we always seem to want to look at the conflict between Americans and Great Britain over finance matters, so that the Tea Party, again, you know, speaks specifically about the Boston Tea Party, and liberals who criticize the Tea Party sometimes they'll argue about the Boston Tea Party itself too, and say, well, no, it really wasn't what the modern Tea Party says it was.
Right.
I'm just always fascinated that we go toward the, you know, we won that war, is something I often say. We won that war against the British, and we keep talking about it. The war we don't talk about much is the war we had with each other over money, finance, debt, foreclosure, and economic policy. And yet we don't talk about it, but it's the war we keep fighting.
Well, I want to get back to that in just a second. But Dwayne emailed us at UpToDate@KCUR.org saying, what's your guest's opinion on the actual reason for the Boston Tea Party, particularly how it was not so much about the taxation on the people as it was about the unfair advantage given to the East India Company?
Yeah, that's a good example of the more liberal critique of the Tea Party's view, of the modern Tea Party's view of the actual Boston Tea Party, in some ways it was a protest against classic corporate bailout and classic government and business cronyism and so forth. And I think that's a very legitimate way to look at it. And even on the larger issue that the questioner raises, you know, they were not necessarily just protesting taxes. And I think that's one of the ways we've oversimplified. You know, there is that taxation without representation thing we all know. And the representation issue was of great importance even to the Whig founders who created our country. I mean, the representation piece and even the whiskey rebels, I should add, even they were not opposing taxation. They wanted taxes, and they wanted a government that was more in favor of what they considered to be the goals of ordinary people. They weren't objecting to taxes. They objected to taxes that they said were out of proportion to property.
And let's talk a little bit more, because I know you're going to talk about this tonight. What you just said, the war we are still fighting, and it's kind of a civil war then, really. Who's going to win?
Well, that's a great way to put it, yes. And I will be at the library tonight. I will want to talk about that a little bit, the idea that that we are in a kind of civil war, a war among, I think you mentioned in the earlier, a war even in families, that this political war that we're in is actually in some ways a war about money and about how we see our American elemental values when it comes to what government should be doing about public wealth and private wealth. And I think it has gone on through many changes throughout the real Civil War, which we of course talk more about than we talk about this issue, through the whole modern era, through the New Deal era, through the Reagan era of pushback against the New Deal. Throughout this entire period, I think we've been kind of fighting this war with ourselves that we haven't managed to resolve. And I think that lack of resolution goes back to the founding.
All right. Well, let's take a call from Mike in Lawrence. Mike, you are on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. You were talking about the Boston Tea Party, and the thing that always kind of cracks me up with Tea Party people is that originally they were opposing paying taxes to Britain because Britain stopped them from being French during the French and Indian War and was basically asking for them to pay their fair share, and they weren't willing to. And it seems when you hear some of these Tea Party people speak now, all this accountability that they talk about seems kind of hypocritical when they ignore why the whole Boston Tea Party thing happened in the beginning and why they weren't willing to pay Britain for Britain protecting them in the French and Indian War.
Yeah,
that's my comment.
That's, you know, there is a British point of view, which is that these taxes were far, far from onerous. Actually, that British people paid much, much higher taxes than anyone in the American colonies. And all the British were trying to do was raise a revenue in large part, said the British, the caller's quite right, to pay back some of the costs of having protected the colonies, as the British saw it, from the French and the natives during the French and Indian War. So there is a whole other point of view on that. And it's always interesting to get the British point of view on these things. We don't have to adopt it just because we know about it, but we don't need to fear it either. The American colonists looked at that very differently. They actually thought that the British had kind of been warmongering. They felt they had footed a lot of the pain of that war themselves. And they didn't object to – really, at their most pure, they did not object to the raising of revenue in order to balance economic interests throughout the empire. They thought what was wrong was to raise taxes from people not represented in parliament for the purpose just of putting money in the treasury. And that was their issue. At their highest, their issue was at the highest point of their thought, their issue was representation.
Some of this, though, does some of this seem inherent to the American culture at the time? The people who were the colonists, they weren't your followers necessarily. They were pretty entrepreneurial and they were pretty they kind of saw things their own way, and they didn't really like to be told what to do.
Yeah, I think that is a strong element of what was going on in the colonies then, and we still have that, and that's one of the strengths one of the strengths of the culture has always been said to be that entrepreneurial spirit and that sense of individual development. And even people, it's important to note that the people like the Whiskey Rebels, who were in many ways very egalitarian and had a very what we would now associate with modern liberalism, some of their thoughts about government and money we would now associate with modern liberalism. At the same time, we should not underestimate their desire to get their hands in a fair way on the tools of economic development and develop themselves economically. They weren't looking to, sit around the campfire and sing Kumbaya. They were looking to get ahead just like everybody else.
I can understand that. Now, I would like to know, when you debate and research and talk to people on both sides, the Occupy Wall Street side, the Tea Party side, do you have good conversations? Do you feel like you can walk away feeling like that people's minds could be changed on this issue?
I would emphasize the good conversations I have. We all know there's a lot of screaming and yelling out there in the world on TV and on the internet. And, of course, I get that. Yes, I have very good conversations sometimes, both with Tea Party people and with Occupy people. And we debate. I don't come away feeling like, oh, good, I have a chance to change this person's mind necessarily. I feel like we've – what I find useful in those debates is that I am forced – to refine what I'm thinking. I get challenged by something somebody says and I can't deny that they have a point. Well, that pushes me back to, what I'm working on and what I need to think about. And then I refine my argument better or I change my mind.
Change your mind. Yeah. All right. Well, it's been fascinating talking to you. And I'm glad just the country's discussing this, because years ago we weren't. Outside of very small circles. So William Hoagland, you're speaking tonight, this evening, 6:30 at the Kansas City Library Central Branch. A free reception precedes the event at 6, and our viewers, or our listeners, sorry, you'll find more information about this on our website at kcur.org. William, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.